Hello and welcome to The Shape of Work, a podcast series by SpringWorks. My name is Anoop and I am your host. Each week, we'll be talking to top people managers across the world on the future of work and how it's shaping our workplace. So sit back and get ready to find out more from these movers and shakers as we have a no-holds-barred, anything-goes conversation with them about their journey, their insights, their thoughts, and most importantly, their ideas and vision for the workplace of the future. Join in on the conversation, leave a comment, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
Welcome to the Shape of Work podcast. On the episode today, our guest is Christian Espinosa, who is a best-selling author. And Christian, you are talking to us from Hawaii.
I am. I'm in Kona, the big island of Hawaii, one of my favorite places.
Nice.
As you can tell from the picture of the where I'm staying here, the turtles in the background.
Yeah. We have never had a guest from Hawaii. Of course, you know, early morning for you there, end of the day for me, but very, very excited about the conversation that we are going to have today. Like I said, you know, right before we started, hit record on this, this is a topic that is very close to my heart. But before we do that, Christian, let's set some context for the listeners. Tell us a little bit more about yourself. What is it that you do? What's your journey been like?
Right now, I am a managing director for the company that bought my company. Alpine Security is the company that I founded in 2014 and sold in December 2020. So I work for the parent company still in cybersecurity. I also have a personal brand, which is christianespinosa.com. You can get information there. But my purpose is really to help leaders of geeks and geeks themselves develop emotional intelligence. That's an area that I'm passionate about. And I've found through my own journey with my own company that the biggest struggle we faced in a cybersecurity company was the lack of interpersonal or people skills, not the lack of technical ability. So my focus is on helping move the industry, cybersecurity forward and actually elevate humanity, because there's a lot of today, especially a lot of people are kind of losing that emotional intelligence because of all the technology and social distancing and all the other things we've been doing. So I think it's important to bring that back. For my own journey, I used to be in the military. I used to be in the Air Force. I went to the Air Force Academy as an Air Force for like six years. Then I did Department of Defense contracting. Then I did some commercial work. And it's all been cybersecurity focused. So I had ultimately like a 25-year, almost 30-year career. I did a solopreneur or freelance work for a while. And then I started my own company in 2014. So I sort of like seen the entire landscape from, you know, defense jobs to commercial jobs to being a solopreneur or freelancer to being an entrepreneur and having my own company to now having sold the company and working for somebody else.
Yeah, that is the whole gamut of experience. And of course, like you said, I was going through your LinkedIn profile and you are a very well-known cybersecurity expert. And that is what happens to many people in the tech domain as well. You have sort of done, you know, your research on it. You've come out of it. You've explored yourself. You've discovered yourself. But other technology leaders, they get very good, like you said, at the technical skills, at the technological skills. They are very good at what they do, but the interpersonal skills, like you mentioned. And the other aspect to this is, of course, you know, taking just a step back at this. At this stage, you know, we are assuming they are already technical managers. But if we take a step back, there is this situation where, you know, there are excellent individual contributors who are very, very good at what they do. Mm-hmm. And then the expectation from them, the default expectation is that they hire more people and, you know, magically start to manage them. And that often leads to a lot of trouble, because especially in the technical space, technology developers, engineering, those sort of engineering managers, these are people who love to execute. These are people, for example, developers who love to code. They don't really do very well with management. So do you think there is a scope? Do you think there is a demarcation where you say, you know, okay, these people are not meant to be managers? Or do you think everyone can learn managerial skills?
Good question. I think everyone can learn leadership skills. I don't think everybody is given the right opportunity to learn leadership skills. And I don't think everybody actually wants to be a leader. So when you hit on a couple of good points, as a organization, and this happens all the time. You see it, you take your best software developer and decide, oh, we need a team now. We're going to make this person our best coder, the team lead, and have them supervise the team and hire new people with zero training on leadership. We just automatically assume that this skill is just innate. I don't believe that's the case. And somebody that's super great technically doesn't, and that's what they're focused on, doesn't make a super great leader. They can, but they need some coaching and some training and the overall organizational support to make that happen. And we set ourselves up for disaster by just promoting somebody, you know, without giving them that training. And this happens in cybersecurity all the time. We take the best technical person and make them the CISO for an organization, the Chief Information Security Officer. And then we wonder why we're failing miserably in cybersecurity, why the board of directors is not giving us a budget, why our team is not collaborating properly. It's because this person that's now in charge, the CISO, doesn't know how to communicate effectively because they're still have this technical mindset and they don't understand, like, well, these people I'm speaking with are business people and they understand things differently than, you know, the technical person. So I need to alter how I communicate because the ownership is on me to get the right response, which is the budget. And we talk about this all the time in cybersecurity. And that's why I wrote my book, was a lot of these issues. It wasn't so much on the leadership aspect. I believe in self-leadership. So there's that component, but also just in general, a lot of technical people want to get, well, they do get their significance by being smarter than other people. And if you're always trying to be smarter than somebody and your ego is trying to protect that identity, it makes it hard to collaborate. It makes it hard to communicate with a prospect or a client in a way that they understand it. So all these things kind of manifest together, especially when you take that person and make them a leader.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point there. I mean, if you think about it, if you are in the smartest person in the room, you are in the wrong room, that, you know, very old adage. But more importantly, if you don't open up, essentially, you know, the concept of servant leadership, right? If you are being egotistical about it, or if you don't let your team know your vulnerabilities, for example, those are the sort of things that build a great team, that build trust within the team. What are some of the other challenges that you see with these people over and over again?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, and that's, I talk about it, you know, in my book, I have a 7-step methodology to address some of these issues. You know, like awareness is one of them, mindset, communication. There's a lot of, you know, things if we unpack this, but basically it's being able to let go of this desire to always be significant in a way that makes you want to be smarter than other people. So once you gain that awareness and you're able to break some of those habits and actually connect with people, because if you're always trying to be smarter than someone and that's how you get significance, we all want to be significant. But when you're always trying to be smarter than someone, it sort of like creates a divide with other people, which puts a glass ceiling on you. Because if you can't connect with people, you're not going to collaborate very well with them. You're not going to communicate very well with them. You're not going to empathize very well with them. And that holds you down. And then a lot of the highly technical people get frustrated because they're like, well, nobody understands me. You know, I work really hard. I'm not getting promoted. And it shows up in all these ways where it's really because of that desire to be so significant by being smarter than other people is really what's holding you back.
Yeah, I can relate with that, Christian. I can totally relate with that. You have to shine light on different members of your team rather than always trying to hog the limelight. And
yeah,
in my short time having managed people, the most satisfaction that I have gotten personally is when people I have taken a bet on and they have, you know, exponentially just grown in their role and, you know, achieved, I mean, yeah, just achieved a lot in a very, very short span of time. But again, you know, of course, this is a problem that you understand very, very well. And I would say, because of the fact that I am asking these this question so very often, mm-hmm. I'm assuming all the execs also understand this. Is it just a matter of laziness that they are not trying to solve for this? Or is it something else?
I think it's a matter of this tolerance and this acceptance we've allowed. We sort of have made this assumption that if you have like a high IQ, like you're super bright technically, that it's automatic that you have a low EQ or low people skills. Mm. And we've sort of like pushed this idea forward and accepted it and tolerated it in a manner where we just kind of think this is just the way it is.
Yeah.
And the reality is it doesn't have to be that way, but we've sort of like just allowed it to be that way. And it's, you know, we even have memes about it and all this, there's shows about it where the highly technical person is making fun of someone or talking over someone's head. We, as a society in general, we've accepted this. And I think that acceptance is part of the problem. I'm a believer that you get what you tolerate, and we've been tolerating this. And I think in order for us to get more effective at cybersecurity or more effective at our technical challenges, we need to stop tolerating this and hire people and hold people accountable, not just for their technical skills, but also for their people skills, their emotional intelligence, and their cultural and core value fit with the organization. And one of the things I did initially, and I made all these mistakes myself, when I started my own company, I hired people purely on their technical skills. I thought, you know, in cybersecurity, what matters is someone's technical skills. I just basically ignored the people skills part. And when I looked at all the problems I had in my organization, 99% of them were because of a lack of people skills or interpersonal skills, not because of a lack of technical skills. So then I flipped the script and only hired people that met the people skills first and our core value fit. And then if they did met those, I would look at their technical skills. But a lot of people don't actually flip that script. They just keep hiring highly technical people and wonder why they have problems.
Yeah. You know, I read this a couple of weeks back. Very hard hitting. Code is easy. People are hard.
That sums it up.
but Christian, you know, where do you strike that balance? You know, of course, now you are looking at people skills first, and then, you know, technical skills come. Couple of questions here. One, how do you even, like, it's very easy to figure out someone's technical skills, not that easy to figure out people skills. So have you sort of created some mental models? Is there some sort of a test for you to figure out that? Number two, you said, you know, for cultural fit, and, you know, feel free to break this down into the two questions that these are. How much of culture fit do you want to do versus culture add, right? As in, what I'm trying to say is, if everyone is of the same mindset, if everyone's thinking is the same, is that the best team to have? Like, who is questioning mm-hmm. these? If everyone's thinking similarly, who is the person that's questioning the decisions being made? So yeah, those two questions.
Right. One of the things that I did when I looked at the problems of my organization was there were basically problems where somebody's behavior was out of alignment with what I believed to be the proper behavior. So I created core values. I used to think core values are, you know, a bunch of garbage that companies just make it up. But then I found myself where I needed these values. So I created core values. I had 7 of them. Like ownership is one of them, for instance. Communication is another one. And we had them in like phrases like listen intently and respond clearly, for instance, is one of them. So we had these core values. And then what I did is anyone in the organization, we rated them on how well they met the core values. And then anyone we hired, we would ask them questions about scenarios to see if they embrace these core values. And it's not like you can just sort of like set this and forget it. You have to do a lot of enforcement of the culture. And once I did the core values and started hiring people, which required us to ask about the core values and ask about their past experience and how they solve something. For instance, if ownership is one of our core values, we ask a question about having someone give an example of when something didn't go well and how they handled it. That'll give you an indicator of how, what they view about ownership, for instance, or an example of when they talked to somebody and that person didn't understand how they handled that. That would give an idea of how they communicate as well as ownership. So we would ask these questions in the interview. And then once we hired somebody, every 6 months, periodically, we would rate them on how well they're performing against those core values. And then also hold people accountable throughout the normal day-to-day activities against those core values. So those are a couple of things we did. And then also, I think as an organization, the responsibility is on you not just to just assume everybody knows something. You have to do some training and enforce that culture, like I mentioned. So we would do training like every Thursday for an hour. We would do some sort of training on, you know, how to communicate with our clients better, emotional intelligence, how to be more productive, you know, a lot of things that aligned with our core values. We would do training along that as well.
Got it. Yeah. In software, they say, you know, dry, don't repeat yourself. But in leadership, it's just the opposite. Constantly repeat yourself. You have to keep reiterating. Kristen, the other question was, now if everyone has been hired for the same core values, and of course, you know, I mean, that's fair. But what the question that I had was, if everyone is in the same mold or the mm-hmm. same culture fit, does that mean the questions are not being asked when the decision, because everyone has sort of the same thought process? Like the old age old question of, you know, culture fit versus culture ad.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying with that. And that goes back to the core values again. With the core values, there has to be, in part of the culture, there has to be an acceptance that it's okay to disagree with things and to bring things up. Like one of, you know, our core values is to find the opportunity in every situation, for instance. So if we have a problem, and that's a core value, if somebody comes at it from a different angle and sees an opportunity, then that's accepted, right? Okay. Another one is to grow beyond your comfort zone. It's basically to have a growth mindset. So if I'm a leader and I make a decision, but someone is afraid to speak up, then I'm not, you know, embracing the core value. We're not embracing that culture. So if they speak up and it allows us to grow as an organization and maybe make a different decision, that's part of the culture as well. Because you don't want, at least I didn't want, in my organization, a bunch of people that just, you know, were yes men or whatever. They just did whatever I said. Because I don't always have all the pieces of the puzzle because I'm not doing the work in most scenarios. So it's important to get that feedback and to keep have the open environment where people will speak up. So that's part of the culture as well. Because you don't want everyone just to be clock in and clock out, be disengaged and be afraid to speak up.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, that clarifies it very, very well. And now, one of the things that you mentioned, Christian, earlier is these interpersonal skills, that the EQ side of things, that many of these, you know, technical managers or people who might be very, very good at technical skills may not be good at. So what sort of things do you recommend companies do or, you know, maybe the clients that you work with? How do you sort of help them build interpersonal skills for their technical managers so that they can become better leaders, better managers?
Well, one thing they can do is read my book. I go over a framework in the book, a 7-step. I try to simplify it because one of the challenges is, like, when you say emotional intelligence, like, where do you begin? There's like, you know, 17, if you Google it, there's like a million different things on it. Yeah. Do I like learn about how to communicate with someone? Do I learn about this? And I've broken that down into 7 steps I cover in my book. The first one is awareness. You have to understand where you fit into the world and how your interactions with the world impact other people. And then also how you have these blind spots, these triggers that when someone says something or someone looks at you or you hear something a certain way, you kind of go on autopilot and just execute this program that's in your brain. And it's important to realize that and what triggers that so you can do a control C or stop that pattern from running and install or run a different program. So there's a lot of elements, but it always starts with awareness. So that's like step one I cover in my book. And the second step is mindset. There's a fixed mindset, a growth mindset. A lot of people believe that they're just hardwired. Like, I'm just not good with people, they'll say, or I just don't know how to do that. And that's a limiting belief. And that's a fixed mindset. We're not naturally good at a lot of things. We didn't learn how to, you know, we weren't born walkers or talkers. We had to learn how to walk and talk. And we made a lot of mistakes along the way. We fell down as we're learning to walk. And it's the same thing. If you're not good with people, you can get better with people. You just need to practice and you're probably going to make mistakes along the way. And that's okay because you're making improvements. So I talk about all these things in my book in 7 steps. And I try to break it down in a simple way for people to easily digest. Like with communication, which is one of the fourth step of my methodology, I talk about how the meaning of communication is the response you get. A lot of people forget that. But if I'm talking to somebody and they're not understanding, the ownership is on me to alter how I communicate so they actually understand. A lot of us just say, throw up our hands and get frustrated, like, well, they just don't get it. You know, they don't understand, without like turning the mirror back at us and thinking, how am I contributing to this problem? Maybe I need to change how I'm communicating so they do get it. So I break all these things down in a 7-step methodology that has an order to it. And I think, you know, based on feedback I've received, that it's helped a lot of people because I've made it, try to make it simple.
Fantastic. And the book is called Smartest Person in the Room.
That's right. The Smartest Person in the Room.
Available on Amazon, I'm guessing. We will definitely have it in the show notes. Kristen, one important thing here. Now, of course, you know, the company has realized the importance of, you know, teaching these skills that maybe, you know, their technical managers do need, augmentation of their interpersonal skills and such. How do you go about getting buy-in from these people? Because, you know, like you said, they do think they are the smartest person in the room. So, you know, just accepting the fact that they need this training to get better at something they might just assume they are good at. How do you get that buy-in from these people?
That's a challenge. It's easy when you hire new people to make sure they're already bought in before you hire them. But with your existing staff, you need to get their buy-in. You just don't want to, like, you know, let everybody go and start over. It's not practical. So part of the buy-in is pointing out in a manner that's tangible or relatable to them how these skills would be beneficial to them. Because a lot of coders or developers or technical people, they make it sound like they don't interact with people. But then when you like peel back the layers of the onion, they've got a spouse, they have children, they have parents, they've got neighbors, they have coworkers. So they've got all these people they interact with. And if you peel back another layer, the relationships are probably all not like perfect. You know, there's probably some challenges there.
Yeah.
So if you can sort of get buy-in from them by saying, if you learn these things, it'll help with some of these issues you have over here. It will also help you with some of these challenges over here. And one of the things that a lot of people like to say is how smart they are, but they only quantify smartness by, you know, IQ, or I'm super smart with technology. And what I always like to think, if you're super smart, all facets of your life should reflect that, including how you deal with people, including, you know, your wealth, including your health, all of it. It shouldn't just be one little thing, right?
Correct.
So it's shifting the mindset from, you know, it goes back to that cultural thing where it's great to be super smart intellectually and have a high IQ. and you've demonstrated a high aptitude in that area. So that same aptitude can be leveraged to develop better skills in this area over here, which is dealing with people, for instance.
Yeah.
So there's some ways to get the buy-in, you know, but it ultimately depends. If someone is sort of hell-bent on being the smartest person in the room and saying, well, I don't need that garbage, that's a woo-woo stuff, at some point you have to make a decision, do I want this person in my organization? Because not everybody is going to want to be bought in. Okay. Some people are going to still cling to the old belief that I'm really good with technology, but I'm horrible with people. And if you can't find a role for that person in the closet where they don't work with people, then maybe it's time to let that person go.
Yeah. No, you brought up a very, very important point. Like, if you are that smart, if you have this high IQ, why are you only good at your whatever technical skills work? Why isn't other things in place? And I think that goes back to the very fact that as humans, we sort of have intertwined our purpose, our existence here on Earth to what we do. So basically where we work at, you ask any person in a party, you know, who are you? They'll just tell you, oh, I'm, you know, vice president of this at this. And that's where I think there is some dissonance, because people do essentially think their life is, work is life, life is work, whatever. That's what their identity is. And I think once you are able to separate work from your identity of, you know, relationships and such, Have you seen this happen often with people that you've worked with?
Yeah, 100%. And I talk about that in my book. And, you know, like you said, when you're at a party and you ask somebody to tell you about themselves, they automatically start telling you about their job, their role, or they'll give you a title. Yeah. And we sort of like attach these labels to everybody, like, oh, I'm a salesperson, I'm an executive in a company, I'm a programmer. And what happens is we have these labels, we automatically apply this stereotype, where the reality is the person's more than that label. Yeah. That's just what they happen to do for a career. I don't like when people ask me what I do about for work. I prefer to, like, because I feel like it's dehumanizing. It's like, yeah, there's more to me than just the thing I do at work. I like to go hike. I like to read books. I like to do all these other things too, right? So I think that's a big problem. And people tend to only focus on that because we've been conditioned in society to like identify with our career and introduce ourselves with our career. So we naturally think, well, this is the skill, the only thing that matters, you know, is my IQ and my technical job, for instance, versus my relationships and the impact I'm having in my neighborhood, for instance. And that's more impactful in some regard than, you know, how well you write code, for instance.
Yeah. Definitely. That conditioning is has been ingrained in us from the very beginning, from the childhood. Mm-hmm. One thing that you brought up and I wanted to touch upon very, very, very early was, you know, with social distancing and, of course, remote work now, do you think the problems have just compounded?
100%. with since COVID happened and everybody's been working at home, a lot of people, based on my experience of my network, their staff doesn't want to go back to work, the technical people. Because some of these people are very, you know, introverted. They would self-identify as an introvert. And now you put them in a scenario where they don't have to physically work with anybody or physically go to an office. So they may have been making progress, you know, with their interpersonal skills, but now all that progress has been rolled back because they've got super comfortable working at their kitchen table or their home office with their dog or their cat, and that's it, right? So they, I think it's actually hindered a lot and rolled back a lot of the progress we've made, this work from home movement.
Mm. But do you think there is a space there for some people who are maybe a little more extroverted? Can, you know, of course, like you said, there was some improvement happening when these people were going to office, they had to interact with other people. But do you think there is a space there to say, you know, okay, let these people be, let them focus on their craft, which is the technical skills, and let these other people who may not, be this type of people who want to be holed up at home and only code, we will just work on them for the managerial side of things. Is that even possible? Or do you think, you know, that's the wrong approach to take?
Yeah, I think that's possible. I don't think everyone, needs to interact at the same level. I think if you're a developer and you've got clear guidance on what sort of code you're supposed to develop and what the inputs and the outputs are of your program, for instance, and you've got a project manager that keeps things on track, you don't necessarily need to work with people unless you're working with a team and you're doing a module of a program, for instance. So there are scenarios where I don't think everyone needs to, develop the same degree of people skills. But at some point, even if you're that developer working from home, you've got a project manager, you've got a client you've got to talk to about the code, you've got someone that's working the front end, maybe. You still have people you have to deal with. So there's still skills that need to be developed and cultivated, but maybe not to the degree of someone that's a salesperson, for instance. And the salesperson obviously is going to be more out there. The developer, I don't see a problem with people working from home or limiting their contact with people if that's serving them, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people, they get depressed if they don't have the human connection. And we've seen this with COVID. A lot of, mental health issues have gone on the increase because people no longer have that human connection. So that's something to be cognizant of as well. I mean, you could have the developer that you think they're completely happy working alone and isolated, but maybe they're mentally not, right? So there's some components that we need to be cognizant of as well.
Fantastic conversation. I've loved every minute of it, Christian. And, I feel like, all the questions that I mentioned to you that I keep asking other guests, I was able to get the answers to almost all the questions in this one single episode, and which means the listeners will also derive a lot of value out of it. Christian, if listeners want to connect with you or read more from you, of course you are on LinkedIn, but where else can they go?
They can go to my website. It's christianespinoza.com. They can find my book on the website or on Amazon as well. And I'm on all social media, Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn, like you mentioned.
Fantastic. We will, of course, put we already have all of these in the show notes, because by the time you're listening, this is already live. But once again, thank you so much, Christian, for taking time out for coming on the Shape of Work podcast and, answering all my queries. And in doing that, you have, of course, answered the queries of the listeners. I'm pretty sure most listeners have these questions as well. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a great conversation. I appreciate it.